Welcome to today's podcast, which is presented in conjunction with Information Security Magazine's 10th anniversary issue. I'm Michael Momoso, editor of Information Security, and I'll be talking with Phil Zimmerman. Phil is a cryptography pioneer and creator of PGP, the world's most widely used in email encryption software. I talked to Phil about his development of PGP, his battles with the U.S. government over crypto exports, and about his latest project, ZPhone, which encrypts voice over IP. I start off my conversation with Phil talking about the dynamic, fast-moving nature of the information security market during the past 10 years.
Well, I think maybe the reason why it's so dynamic is because there's an arms race, and arms races greatly accelerate processes that would normally proceed very slowly. The arms race, of course, now in recent years has been between organized crime and the IT security industry. Before, a few years ago, if somebody attacked your computer, it was probably a teenager in a black t-shirt that wanted to take your PC out for a joyride. But now, it's attacked within minutes of attaching your PC to the internet. It's attacked by organized crime that wants to commandeer it for some major criminal enterprise. This has increased their efficiency and power enormously compared to people just attacking, hacking into your computer for pleasure. And it's turned the internet into a rough neighborhood. So another thing that's happened is that in the past decade is that at the beginning of the past decade, encryption was still illegal. I mean, not illegal, but discouraged. It was, kind of frowned upon.
Right.
You weren't allowed to export it in the U.S. The French, I think, had just changed 10 years ago to allowing it to be used domestically. I don't remember what year they did that, but it was roughly 10 years ago. The British were more hostile toward it 10 years ago. In fact, those three countries were the sort of triumvirate of the crypto controls worldwide.
Right.
The other European countries were generally not that friendly toward others having their own access to crypto.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the 90s, that crumbled. The French sort of led the way of the dissolution of that triumvirate. And then the Brits backed off on some of their domestic controls, and finally the Americans had to finish the relaxation of their export controls. And PGP had a lot to do with that, because at that time we were in the process of exporting unlimited quantities of crypto code to Europe by the use of printed books with OCR scanning. You know, before we did that, it was unwieldy and difficult to export cryptography legally.
Mm-hmm.
For an export license, you certainly couldn't export it just anywhere. You might be able to export it to one particular customer, maybe a bank or something. But PGP, a decade ago, started exporting the entire code base of PGP in printed form, in books. And that turned out to be fairly difficult, because OCR of C source code is not as easy as OCR of natural language like English or French or Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Because the OCR packages had spelling dictionary assistance for resolving ambiguities, which were worse than useless for the source code. We had to develop our own tools and heuristics for correcting errors automatically. Once we developed those tools, it became possible to export tens of thousands of pages of source code, fast as the sheet feeders can keep up in OCR scanners in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And that blew a hole in the export controls, led to government realizing that they couldn't keep it up any longer.
Right.
Well, if you fast forward to today, compare today's legal landscape with that one. Instead of discouraging cryptography is encouraged. In fact, it's encouraged so you can get into trouble for not using it.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at Senate Bill 1386 in California, the disclosure laws that we have here, you know, saying that if a laptop is stolen with 200,000 customer names on it, you've got to tell the public. You've got to tell your customers that their identities may have been, you know, well, were stolen. And that's, you know, that punishes companies for exposing customer data like that. But you don't have to tell them if the data is encrypted. Climate encourages the use of encryption. And more than half the states in the U.S. have similar laws. So the overall legal landscape today is friendly toward encryption. And it was hostile toward encryption a decade ago.
Did you ever think you'd see the day?
I didn't think it was going to get friendly toward encryption. No, I knew that eventually they would have to give up because it's, you know, it's like trying to stop the tides.
What was the disconnect with the government in retrospect? I mean, as you had some years to evaluate it, I mean, was there a disconnect? What was their, what were they failing to see?
You know, historically, encryption had a huge impact on military and diplomatic communications. You know, if you go back to World War II, Battle of Midway was decided by the U.S. intercepting and breaking Japanese encrypted communications.
Mm-hmm.
We all know about Enigma, you know, importance of being able to break Enigma. World War II was full of that. The Allies were able to break all of the codes of the Axis powers. And they weren't able to break ours at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there were military outcomes, important military outcomes that were strongly influenced by the ability to break encryption and the ability to keep the enemy from breaking encryption. So their mindsets were influenced by those historic events. And I think, you know, that's where those policies originally came from. But with the Internet and the information age, everyone else needed encryption just to conduct their lives on the Internet. So it took them a while to wake up and smell the coffee.
What was the turning point for encryption as a business enabler? Was it the fact that so much business moved onto the Internet itself, or was it regulation or something else?
Well, I think that regulation comes from, or changes in regulation come from recognition of the facts on the ground. I would say that the changes of the facts on the ground where was the turning point.
Mm-hmm.
That provided the pressure, the political pressure. There were legal challenges, there were lawsuits against the government to deregulate cryptography. There were two other civil litigation projects underway in addition to my criminal case. Plus, Congress was moving. The executive branch was beleaguered by the other two branches of government, and they had to act. They were, you know, if they didn't act, one of the other two branches of government would have acted. Both of those were enabled by changes in the facts on the ground. And part of what we did in the early days of PGP was changing the facts on the ground. The publication of PGP itself, the first version and early versions of PGP, certainly changed the facts on the ground. And then the other, we had the audacity to put it in books that were not subject to export controls and undertook the difficult and technically challenging task of doing OCR scanning of C source code, something OCR technology was never designed to do,
mm-hmm.
and turning that into a smooth operation to export unlimited quantities of crypto. Most people don't know about the importance of the OCR scanning project. But that had a huge effect. It meant that we had an unlimited pipeline of crypto sent to Europe for commercial exploitation in Europe. Before we had that, it actually, the export controls actually accelerated European competence in cryptography. Now, we were creating a market opening for the Europeans to develop their own core competencies in cryptography. Americans had the edge on that before the American cryptographers had to start fighting with the government for the right to export it.
What What's your take on the current state of encryption developments? I mean, there's always persistent talk of certain algorithms being broken, and SHA-1, for example, a couple of years ago, there's a lot of talk around that. I mean, what's your take on
that's certainly an exciting aspect to things. I think it was Adi Shamir that said that one morning he woke up, or he was either waking up or going to bed, I don't know which it is, but thinking that hash functions are one of the best understood areas of cryptography, and the next day waking up and discovering that they're one of the least understood areas of cryptography. Professor Wang has earthquaked through the crypto community. Now we have a new project to develop a hash function at NIST that is sort of like the AES competition, and that's a good thing. Let's see, what else was you want to know about what algorithms being broken? The ones that we depend on the most are, aside from the hash functions, the other ones, the block ciphers, the public key algorithms, we depend on in real products, have been pretty solid. There's some hand-wringing going on about quantum computing possibly being a threat to public key algorithms, but I don't really feel very worried about that. Quantum computing is very difficult to do on the kind of scale you need to go after. Kind of public key sizes that we use today. I think someone has factored the number 15 using quantum techniques. But that's number 15 is a long way from being an RSA key.
Right. Can you update me on Z Phone?
Well, that is a really exciting project. I'm glad you asked me about that. I've been wanting to encrypt phone calls since before I was interested in encrypting email. You know, in the 1980s, in the early 1980s, I was interested in encrypting phone calls.
Uh-huh.
But, the technology wasn't there yet. You know, microprocessors weren't very fast. You know, we all were using the public switch telephone network at that time. It was after developing PGP that I, started working on real VoIP encryption, and that was PGP phone in 1995. But, the Internet wasn't ready then either. I mean, microprocessors were fast enough, but the rest of the Internet wasn't ready. No one had broadband. And also, there were no VoIP standards. All that's changed now. What a difference a decade makes. Now we have a whole VoIP industry growing up. It's time to address it again because, we didn't absolutely have to have email encryption. I mean, we need email encryption, but it wasn't vital as much as VoIP encryption is. Because we've enjoyed phone calls being relatively secure by the PSTN. The PSTN is physically well protected compared to the Internet. There isn't that much wiretapping going on, except by the government, because the government has a kind of an asymmetric advantage. They can just go to the phone company and ask for a wiretap and get one. But, other entities outside the government find it more difficult to wiretap. Sure, somebody could come with alligator clips to your office and find the wires outside your building and go through the thousands of wires, and try to figure out which one goes to your phone on your desk. The Russian mafia would have to get a U.S. visa to come here to do something like that with alligator clips in their pockets.
Yeah.
Have to get close enough. Yeah, so if you can get close enough to attach alligator clips, then, that's going to rule out everybody else outside the U.S. from wiretapping us.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Internet, with VoIP, all that changes. Now it's possible to be wiretapped from people on the other side of the world.
Right.
Because they can inject spyware into one of the many PCs that are in your building. And that PC could intercept all the packets on your local network, including VoIP packets. And then someone from the other side of the world could browse through them with a web browser, choosing which ones they want to listen to. The asymmetry of difficulty of wiretapping between the government and other people doing it collapses as we migrate to VoIP. That asymmetry has been important. Our judicial ecosystem has come to depend on that asymmetry. But if will be able to wiretap judges and prosecutors and listen to them discussing ongoing criminal investigations, or the names of witnesses and informants, and listen to them calling their wives at home to talk about what time to pick up their kids at school. That could that could be very dangerous to the operation of our criminal justice system. If you look at journalism in Russia, maybe about 12 or 15 journalists have been murdered in Russia for criticizing Putin.
Mm-hmm.
And when you compare that to the total number of journalists in Russia, it's a small number.
Right.
But in arithmetic numbers, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But its effects on the behavior of all the thousands of journalists is huge. Well, how many incidents of criminals listening to judges and prosecutors talk to their families on the phone about where to pick up their children is it going to take to, you know, eviscerate the criminal justice system? The people that we normally think would be opposed to encrypting phone calls are probably going to realize that they need it as much as the rest of us.
Is it still at an evangelism state where the benefits need to be explained, or is it just a matter of like going really mainstream before a realization sets in?
Well, interesting question. If you look at what people in the security industry were saying a few years ago, they would try to project some pessimistic futures about, you know, what could happen, you know, on the internet, not VoIP, but the internet as a whole. And none of the doomsayers of that time, even the most pessimistic doomsayers, were outright Pollyannish compared to the reality that has since unfolded. The internet has become far worse than anyone imagined, than any pessimistic doomsayer ever projected. We have to look at what's going to happen to VoIP now, before it gets that way. The internet grew to a size that attracted organized crime. VoIP is too small right now to attract organized crime, to exploit it, to attack it. But it will grow. Everyone knows VoIP is growing. And at some point, it's going to be big enough, and it will be a phase change, just like it was on the internet. We have to protect VoIP with encryption before that tipping point is reached. And so this is the right time for my new project. The approach that I'm taking doesn't require a public key infrastructure. It doesn't require trusting the phone company. So I think that we're probably going to see, as time goes on, more and more deployment of VoIP encryption, and hopefully the protocol that I'm pushing.
That concludes my conversation with Phil Zimmerman. Remember to log on to searchsecurity.com/10th anniversary for more exclusive content related to Information Security Magazine's 10th anniversary issue. I'm Michael Momoso, editor of Information Security. Thank you for listening.